Hawaii's Death with Dignity Law is set to go into effect January 1st. The law allows terminally ill patients to request a lethal prescription to voluntarily end their lives. Including Hawaii, there are now five states, plus the District of Columbia, that allow medical aid in dying. The nonprofit group Compassionate Choices advocates for improved access to medical aid in dying. Dr. David Grube is a retired family physician and the National Medical Director for Compassionate Choices. He spent his career practicing in Oregon, which was the first state in the nation to allow medical aid in dying. He was in Hawaii to help healthcare professionals navigate what's coming up. He spoke with The Conversation's Ryan Finnerty.
So I practice in a very small town in Oregon, and I've practiced there since 1977. The law in Oregon passed in 1996, but actually took effect in 1997. It wasn't until about 1999 that a first patient who was dying came to me requesting support and help and wanted to consider using the Death with Dignity law. I had no experience in that, although I've taken care of many people that were dying and have been involved in hospice since 1980. This was new to me, so I needed to reach out, and I reached out to a medical director of a hospice, Dr. Cleaver, and he and I met and talked, and he taught me how to respond to the request, to ask questions of the patient about what they really need, what they really want, to make sure that their family knows about their request, and to begin to understand all the complexities and very difficult things that they're going through. So that process happened, and then since that time, over the years, once perhaps or twice a year, a patient might want to talk about this.
And this is something that a lot of doctors have a big ethical problem with, so I imagine it's not really something that's covered in most medical schools, especially since it's not legal in every state. Are young doctors getting experience with how to handle these type of cases?
So I think it goes even deeper than that. I think historically, and this may shock you or may not, but historically doctors haven't been taught much about dying, the dying process, about how to talk about death, end-of-life experiences. So actually nationally, in all states, in all medical schools, this has become a kind of a focus. People are living longer, and it's very complicated to die in America. It doesn't, especially if you're in a health system and you're in the hospital with our wonderful new technologies. So historically, right, there's been no education. However, now in Oregon, both medical schools we have in Oregon teach end-of-life classes, including Death with Dignity. And schools I know in California, Washington, and Colorado teach end-of-life courses that include medical aid in dying, or as you would have in Hawaii, the Our Care, Our Choice Act.
Well, there are five states across the country, including Hawaii and then also the District of Columbia, that have some type of Death with Dignity law. Are they fairly uniform, or do they vary from state to state?
Very, very uniform. The Oregon law, which was, as I said, is 21 years old, hasn't been changed a word in all that time. So it's effective and works well. So all the other states modeled their law on the Oregon law. Hawaii's new act is almost the same, a few little differences here and there, but pretty much the same.
And it takes effect January 1st. So that's when patients are eligible to request this type of service. What types of issues have you encountered over your professional career when it comes to actually carrying out these types of requests?
Well, first of all, we need to look at each individual case and make sure that we understand what the patient's values and priorities are, and whether other kinds of things are bothering them, and is this appropriate to even be talking about. But if you go through all that, and particularly if you listen, sit down and listen, each person has a backstory that is different, and we need to address those. I try to make sure every person is involved in hospice and has a hospice nurse and personnel to help them. So I think that's very, very important. And then address their cultural and religious issues, make sure that we understand, you know, those aren't going to be a conflict for them. And, of course, personally, and I think you asked this question and I didn't answer it, we have to look at ourselves and understand if this is aligns with our professional integrity.
Well, and on that line, many doctors do consider this at odds with the Hippocratic Oath that all physicians take. How have you squared those somewhat conflicting ideas in your professional career?
That's a great question. So if you really look at it, no doctor takes the Hippocratic Oath and hasn't for almost 20 years. It's not used in any medical schools anymore. There are new oaths, the Physician's Oath, the Geneva Ethical Code, etc. So that everyone always brings that up, oh, the Hippocratic Oath, but it doesn't really exist. It's not a thing. So the prime issues that you think about, I think, in this regard are patient autonomy. In other words, an intelligent adult has the right to choose to have any treatment or not have that treatment. And beneficence, do good things for people, make sure to help them. Primum non nocere, which means don't do harm, do no harm. And that's also called non-maleficence. And historically, I think we doctors and healthcare professionals have been the ones that have defined harm. But I think we're learning to understand that actually the patient should be the one that defines harm. And if they feel that the treatments they're going through are onerous and their suffering is terrible, that may be harmful. So so I think medical aid in dying aligns with all those things, particularly patient autonomy, beneficence, and non-maleficence.
And now that this procedure is legal in several states, and it has been for a few decades now, if we go back to Oregon's enacting of it, have there been any legal challenges over a particular patient trying to either wanting this and their family member not wanting them to do it, or perhaps vice versa, where family members are pushing a patient to get this done and maybe the patient is hesitant?
So nothing in the latter case, of course, because there's protections in our act in Oregon and in your act that this is volitional. There's voluntariness on the part of the patient. All patients are screened about this. They're also, if they're in hospice, they have a bath aide, a nurse, a chaplain, a social worker who will monitor and watch that there's not coercion. In regard to legal action, there have been individual legal actions here and there, none of which have ever come to fruition. There's never been any doctors who've been disciplined. There's been never ever any evidence of abuse or coercion that's ever been recognized. The one legal case that actually kind of happened was in California a few months ago, where a group asked that it not be legal. It was the judge declared it to be held on hold for a few months until it went to appeal. Now it's in appeal, so it's legal again in California, and that case is still to be determined. But really nothing.
What types of protections exist to make sure that there is no unethical or even illegal behavior going on?
Very, very good question. So first of all, it involves two different doctors. So your own doctor has to determine that you understand what you're requesting, that you are about to die. That's called a terminal illness. That you have volition, and that you can self-ingest. In other words, you have to take the medicine yourself. The doctor doesn't give it to you. Then you have to go to a second doctor who does the same thing, has to determine all those things. In Hawaii, you have to go to a third provider, and that gets a mental health assessment. We don't have that in other states, but Hawaii has that third protection, if you will, or maybe even becomes a barrier, because these are very, very sick people. And for them to get in to three different providers, and the first provider, you have to get in twice to see them. Four different visits are protections. A waiting period in Hawaii, it'll be 20 days. You have to wait 20 days between the time that you first asked and the time that medication could be given to you. And then also written protection, so that you actually have to write out that this is what you want to do and has to be witnessed and signed by two different individuals. So quite a number of protections.
So it sounds like a pretty lengthy process.
It can be very lengthy. And indeed, a number of people request this and don't live to get through to a time where they can determine the last chapter of their story.
A lot of people may know the the issue of death with dignity as medically assisted suicide, and there's been a movement to rebrand that towards death with dignity. Do you think there's a difference between those two terms fundamentally?
Fundamentally, complete difference. I think as a clinician, as a doctor who's taken care of patients for 40 years, I can recognize it entirely differently. A suicidal patient generally has some active mental illness. They may have PTSD. They may have drug addiction. They may have a major depressive disorder. And all people who use aid in dying cannot have an active mental illness. They're ruled out. If they have major depressive disorder, they aren't eligible for medical aid in dying. A suicidal patient acts alone and acts too often in a violent way, with a result that's horrible for everyone. Whereas an aid in dying patient acts with their family, they're together with their loved ones, with their music, with their candles, in a very, almost one could say, spiritual situation. And I think then finally and very importantly is a total difference in the grief reaction of the family, the loved ones, and the doctor after both instances. In a suicidal case, we all wonder what could we have done to have kept this person from having this terrible violent action, and we feel terrible about that. In an aid in dying, we feel sad that the person is gone, but they're no longer suffering, and there's a relief there. And so the grief reaction is normal in aid in dying, and it's totally abnormal in a suicidal case. So I think the language is very, very important.
Something I've always wondered about, David, is when someone chooses to die using this medically prescribed means, how does it affect, say, the cause of death that's listed on their death certificate? How does it affect something like life insurance? Does that vary from state to state, or do we have uniform rules, especially considering many insurance companies are national?
The rules are uniform in all cases. It does not impact life insurance. If a person who's aid in dying does not have any restrictions or lose any contracts or contractual benefits. The death certificate is the terminal illness is written, and I'll kind of give you an example. Let's say a patient has lung cancer. They've been through all the treatments, surgery, radiation. It's not working. They're about to die. They use aid in dying medication. We write on the death certificate lung cancer. We don't write a medical aid in dying. And there's really no difference, if you will, think about this, between that and someone who's in the ICU and has a breathing tube removed because they're brain dead. They are going to immediately die from the doctor taking out the breathing tube, but we don't put that on the death certificate. We say brain death from motor vehicle accident. So the death certificate has two parts to it. It has some to determine the estate of the individual and the epidemiological data. All the epidemiological data will be available for the Department of Health through the forms that the doctor completes.
That was Dr. David Grube of the nonprofit group Compassion and Choices, who was speaking with HPR's Ryan Finnerty.